there's a country song that every like fraternity guy in the South loves. The road goes on forever and the party never ends by Robert Earl Keane. It's so beloved by fraternity guys, there's even a country song about how much fraternity guys love this song. Something that I think is pretty true of fraternity culture is the party never ends. No matter who gets arrested, no matter who dies, no matter what happens, there will be a party the next weekend. And sometimes the party is a funeral party, but nothing stops the party. Nothing.
I'm Margot Gray. This week on Campus Files, the story of a multi-million dollar drug ring run by fraternity brothers at the College of Charleston.
So my name's Max Marshall. I'm an investigative journalist from Texas.
Max has written for a bunch of publications, including the New York Times, Texas Monthly, and Esquire. And back in 2016, he was working on a story for GQ about cocaine smuggling in Ho Chi Minh City. It got him thinking about a drug that he'd seen everywhere back when he was in college, Xanax. Xanax is an anti-anxiety pill, and it's often referred to as a bar because of its rectangular shape.
There's a lot of demand both for Xanax as sort of an anti-anxiety drug that you could take if you're stressed out for a test or you're trying to sleep or you're trying to get over a breakup, but also it had this huge demand as a party drug.
Xanax has been around since the 1980s, but it's only in recent years that it's become so popular as a recreational drug.
People would mix it usually with, you know, four or five beers, and it felt like you had 12 or 13 beers, and that was actually a very, very popular, very sought after outcome. I do think it's really telling if you think of the sort of go-to it drug of a different generations, like weed or acid in the 60s, cocaine in the 80s, ecstasy in the 90s. Like the fact that our generation's go-to drug is an anti-anxiety tranquilizer designed for panic attacks, that really says something about our generation.
But Max was less interested in why Xanax was so popular with Gen Z. He wanted to know where all the Xanax on college campuses was coming from, because it definitely didn't look legit.
When I was in college, a lot of the Xanax that I saw wasn't coming from Pfizer, wasn't coming from pharmacies. It didn't even say Xanax on it. It would have some sort of random collection of numbers and letters. And that, of course, got me asking, okay, well, where are these pills coming from?
Max began his research with a simple Google search. He'd mainly seen Xanax in the context of fraternity parties before, so he typed in Xanax fraternity. The top result was an article from the Charleston Post and Courier titled Cocaine, Pills, and Textbooks. It detailed a recent drug bust at the College of Charleston, where police had uncovered a multi-million dollar drug operation. The mugshots? 8 guys, all between 19 and 25 years old. Most were current or former fraternity members.
I saw this sort of row of mugshots, and it was all these guys with kind of the perfect frat swoop haircut. They all kind of had the tans that you get from like playing golf. It actually looked like a fraternity composite.
While the guys arrested may have looked like amateurs, their operation was anything but. In fact, the police report sounded like a Breaking Bad episode, complete with hundreds of thousands of dollars in hidden cash and tens of thousands of black market Xanax pills.
I think it said 41,000 pills. But then, of course, I started talking to some defense lawyers in Charleston, and one of them let it slip that the police had found something closer to 3 million pills. And that's when I knew there was definitely a story there.
Pretty soon, Max was on a flight to South Carolina, bound for the College of Charleston.
Travel and Leisure named College of Charleston the most beautiful campus in America. It's all these revolutionary era, colorful buildings under palmetto trees, and there's Spanish moss hanging from right above you. It's very much out of like a Nicholas Sparks novel or something.
And because of that, it attracts a lot of very wealthy out-of-state kids. Some of the kids in the College of Charleston would pull their literal yachts up to the Charleston deep water dock, and they would fly private to Aspen, and they had allowances to basically go out 6 or 7 nights a week.
When Max first got to the College of Charleston campus, fraternity guys weren't exactly lining up to talk to him about the drug operation.
I mean, at first, really, very few people wanted to talk. And I remember I was telling an editor, I was like, oh, if I'm going to do this story, I need contacts. And he was like, oh, yeah, contacts are important, you know, list of names. I was like, no, I need contacts. Like, I can't wear glasses because I need to look more like these guys. But I do think coming from the South, having been in a fraternity, it definitely helped. I think it maybe made people think that this wasn't just going to be a outsider expose as much as like someone trying to hold a mirror up to his own experience.
When Max finally did get the students to open up, the stories he heard were far more shocking than he'd expected. He'd originally planned to just write an article about the rise of Xanax in Greek life. But as he dug deeper into the drug operation, the story took on a life of its own, eventually becoming the basis for his book, Among the Bros, a Fraternity Crime Story. Here are the broad strokes of that story.
Most of these guys start by dealing weed, kind of for obvious reasons. You know, so many kids smoke and it's not considered, quote unquote, sketchy. But for a lot of these guys, the next step up was Xanax.
Until recently, getting Xanax required either a doctor's prescription or a drug dealer with access to the Pfizer supply chain. But that's no longer the case.
There are very few things, I think, in the history of college drug dealing that changed the way business works more than the dark web.
Think of the dark web as an underground version of Amazon, where people buy and sell illegal goods online. What really sets it apart is the encrypted browser.
With the dark web, the authorities really have no idea who or where you are when you're doing something online.
Using the dark web, guys at Charleston ordered alprazolam powder, which is the active ingredient in Xanax, from labs in southern China. This powder then arrived by mail, hidden inside printer cartridges.
Something a DEA agent told me is that the U.S. Postal Service at this point is the largest drug trafficker by bulk in the world because it's just very easy to send drugs over the mail. You know, I even had a high school friend who was dealing at another school in the South, and he would just get it shipped to the campus mail center, hidden in Rob Schneider DVD jackets.
The next step in the operation was to transform the powder into pills. This took place in beach houses off the coast of Charleston.
And these guys would basically rent one beach house about every month. They had an industrial pill press that could print out a few hundred thousand Xanax pills a month. And they would make hundreds and thousands and ultimately millions of these pills.
The pill press had also been ordered from China through the dark web. And the pills it produced varied in strength. Some contained barely any alprazolam powder, while others had 2 to 3 times the recommended dose.
And they would wear hazmat suits because these machines kick up so much alprazolam dust, and if it gets on you, you can black out pretty quickly.
The pills were carefully packaged inside emptied Skittle bags. Then they were ready for sale.
They would sell them to the fraternity guys at anywhere from 50 cents to a dollar a pill, and they would buy in bulk. They would buy 10,000 at a time. And then these guys would turn around and they would sell them for a lot more.
And the beauty of being in a fraternity was that they had a large client base right at their fingertips.
You know, something a lot of these guys would tell me is, you know, you can walk into a fraternity house and there might be 30 customers waiting for you at one time. They like to buy from guys they know. So you sort of have this incredibly centralized system with a lot of customers in one building.
But they didn't just sell to fraternities on Charleston's campus. They sold to fraternities all across the Southeast. At Ole Miss, South Carolina, Duke, UNC, University of Georgia, and beyond.
Charleston is really well located for this stuff, not far from I-95. People also said because CFC didn't have a football team, like the fraternity guys were more free to travel on weekends. And then in addition to that, you have the fraternity pledge system, which, you know, during hazing, you basically have these freshmen who have to run any errand you tell them to. And so if you give a pledge 10 Skittles bags and say, you got to take this over to Sigma Nu, no questions asked, that's what they would do. It just became this very efficient way of moving these Xanax pills all over Greek life, all around the South.
They were able to move and sell such huge quantities of Xanax at once because the drug doesn't carry a trafficking charge in South Carolina.
You know, you can get caught with 10 pills, you can get caught with 10,000 pills. It's still going to be a possession charge, not a trafficking charge.
Xanax is also much easier to smuggle than a drug like marijuana, since it's lightweight and doesn't have a smell.
Who is going to open a Skittles bag expecting to find a bunch of drugs in there, especially if you're a frat kid driving a Mercedes?
And so I think it was just sort of this perfect storm of, like, there was so much money to be made, and it seemed like there was so little risk.
And so you combine all that, and it's a pretty, quote unquote, rational way to make a nice profit pretty quickly.
The thing is, most of these guys didn't need to make a profit.
People often sell drugs because it's their best and sometimes only economic option. But these were kids who had four-figure allowances, and some kids had much bigger allowances than that.
So it begs the question, why start dealing in the first place?
There's a quote that you would hear sometimes in fraternity life, above the law, under the influence.
Above the law and under the influence perfectly describes how the fraternity guys at the College of Charleston operated. Let me take you on a brief detour to show just how invincible they felt. This detour brings us to Mountain Weekend 2012. Mountain Weekend was an off-campus, weekend-long party hosted by one of the various fraternities involved in the drug operation, Sigma Alpha Epsilon, or SAE. Here's what Max heard about that weekend from his sources.
You know, people were doing cocaine off the mirrors. People were taking psychedelics and having sex under the trees all over. And then a guy drove his Hummer into the water and it got stuck. This was all by like noon. By nighttime, they had stripped a lot of the furniture out of these cabins and started a bonfire. They basically burned everything that was burnable inside these cabins. Just a real destruction of state public property.
While the fire grew, a park ranger arrived at the scene. But the guys in SAE didn't panic. Instead, they doused a football in chemicals, lit it on fire, and tossed it in the park ranger's direction.
And, you know, when I was talking to the guys who were there, I was like, what were the consequences of this? But nothing really happened. Something that a few of the sources told me was their alumni are powerful enough and wealthy enough that, like, if something like that happens, it's sometimes possible to buffer the consequences using generations of wealth.
Max dedicates an entire chapter of his book to the story of Mountain Weekend. For one, it's a lens into why fraternity guys felt like they were above the law and why they believed they could pull off a drug operation without facing consequences. But Max thinks it's also a window into why many of them started dealing in the first place, because of a culture that not only permits, but rewards being above the law.
One thing people would tell me is like, oh, well, SAE is one of the best fraternities at College of Charleston. Just look at what happened at their Mountain Weekend. I thought it was fascinating that that was the story people wanted to tell in terms of why SAE was one of the best fraternities. Because on one level, it's like, they're the best fraternity because, wow, listen to how wild this party is. But it's also they're the best fraternity because they got away with all of that. When you start to break shit and you start to burn things and you start to, you know, break the law, it takes money to get away with it.
Max thinks breaking the law became something of a status symbol. It signaled that you had the money, connections, and power to get away with criminal activity.
Something people often miss when they talk about Greek life is how much it's sort of this never-ending status Olympics. Like, you can really go to any campus in America and ask, what are the three best fraternities and the three best sororities here? And people will immediately have an answer. But what makes one fraternity better than another? like the best college football team is the one that wins the most games, or the best hospital is going to do the best job of saving your life. Why are some fraternities better than others? A lot of it comes down to wealth.
Once you understand that about Greek life, Max says, it's easier to see why these guys would start dealing drugs. There was no quicker way to gain clout or boost status than dealing. And the profits didn't hurt either. Some of the guys were ultimately making so much money that they had to launder their profits through the fraternity's books, disguising drug money as fraternity donations or party expenses.
One of the guys in KA told me, he was like, oh yeah, by the peak of this, our fraternity had, I think his quote was, we had a few $1 million guys and a few six-figure individuals. I do think there's some exaggeration there, but certainly there was very real money to be made.
The money would have kept flowing, and the guys could have continued living above the law, if not for the events of March 4th, 2016. Events that revealed just how reckless and out of control their operation had become. June is here, which means it's finally time to reach for your summer wardrobe. And if you're trying to look good without overheating, Quince is your best bet. Their summer collection has all the warm weather staples: breathable linen, washable silk, and soft organic cotton. I now own their 100% linen pants in more colors than I'd like to admit. And the best part is that you get all that quality without the luxury markup. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince works directly with ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not brand markup. And it's not just clothing. Quince has become a destination for elevated essentials across the home, from kitchen to bedding, making it easy to bring a more premium feel into everyday life. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/campus for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/campus for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/campus.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around, waiting for the track to dry, is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
On the afternoon of March 4th, 2016, two College of Charleston students were playing Call of Duty in their off-campus apartment when a real gunshot rang out. Their housemate and fellow College of Charleston student, Patrick Moffley, had been shot in the chest. Instead of administering first aid, Patrick's housemates frantically set about destroying evidence, flushing drugs down the toilet, and burying their pills in the neighbor's trash. By the time police arrived, Patrick was drifting in and out of consciousness, pressing Chipotle napkins against a gaping wound in his chest. Scattered around his body were hundreds of loose white pills.
We've got brand new video into our newsroom of the scene of a shooting in downtown Charleston. Right now, police are still on the scene of Smith Street after a man was shot there this afternoon.
Patrick was rushed into surgery at a nearby emergency room, but by that evening, he was pronounced dead. The coroner found alprazolam in his bloodstream. Seemingly unfazed by their friend's death, Patrick's housemates left the next day for their spring break trip to Puerto Rico. But in the wider Charleston community, the murder sent shockwaves and dominated local headlines, especially because of the Moffley name.
His dad was a big real estate developer. He built all these houses on Kiowa Island. His mom had run for Congress, and she was on the Charleston School Board.
Police were under intense pressure, not just to find out who killed Patrick Moffley, but also to trace the source of the pills scattered around his body. As it turned out, the two were deeply connected. Investigators soon discovered that Patrick had been murdered by two men he'd met through off-campus drug deals. They'd shown up that night, intending to rob him of his Xanax supply. While Patrick himself wasn't a member of a fraternity, he was tied to the fraternity-run drug operation. And as police dug deeper into where Patrick got his pills and who else was selling, they began to unravel the massive drug operation featuring dark web alprazolam powder, freshman pledges recruited as drug runners, and distribution networks spanning the Southeast.
The DEA got involved, the FBI got involved, the U.S. Postal Service got involved. Things kind of started to unravel from there.
Charleston City Police hope one of their biggest drug busts ever will help curb crime on the streets. We're talking about Xanax, cocaine, and drugs.
In June 2016, 6 months after Patrick's murder, the Charleston police chief held a press conference. He announced that the investigation had resulted in one of the biggest drug busts in the city's history.
Over 43,000 Xanax and synthetic marijuana pills, 734 grams of cocaine.
The suspects, three of whom were KAs and two SAEs, were facing a combined 29 counts of state narcotics charges.
We're working with our federal partners to see about any possibility of federal prosecution.
For the first time, it seemed like fraternity guys at Charleston might actually face some real consequences.
The drug bust happens at College of Charleston, and it feels like it's part of this sort of ending. All these fraternities got kicked off campus. You have students who might be actually going to jail, which is something that's very rare in any sort of fraternity case, whether it's hazing or wrongful death or drug trafficking. It's very rare that kids actually end up going to jail. So it felt like an example of like, oh, things are really changing.
And it felt like the reckoning with fraternity culture was taking place not just at the College of Charleston, but all across the country.
There was a pretty widely publicized string of hazing deaths that sort of happened in the early 2010s. Think pieces in the Atlantic magazine about, you know, why do we have fraternities? And you would see at schools like Amherst, they were getting rid of Greek life. And there's just this kind of sense of, well, like, it was a good run. This might have been it.
The question about whether to abolish Greek life has been percolating for years. Countless opinion pieces have made the argument for why this institution has become toxic.
Even Bill Maher weighed in.
There was a time when fraternities fit in with society as a whole, but that day is long gone.
And I think more generally, the idea of being a bro went from like a kind of comic idea of like a dude who's taking a keg stand to the idea of, you know, what we learn in college and afterward, the idea of toxic masculinity and the idea of bro being this sort of intersectional identity of sort of all the most privileged ways you can be in the world. White, rich, straight, all of these things sort of combined, I think, to this sense that fraternities were not long for this world.
Adding to this sense of shifting tides was the 2016 election, when a lot of people believed we were about to have our first female president.
Obviously, that didn't happen. And I think the election was one marker, but I think the bigger marker was just watching over the next few years, all of these fraternities came back on campus.
By November 2020, just 4 years after Patrick Moffley's murder, Kappa Alpha Order, a key fraternity in the drug operation, was back on the College of Charleston campus.
I was thinking if I was ever talking to a journalism school about the limits of what investigative journalism can do, you just need to go on the KA and SAE Instagram, because their parties are wilder than they've ever been.
In the end, of the eight guys arrested, only one, Mikey Schmidt, served time in prison. The others were given suspended sentences in exchange for helping the police arrest Mikey.
These other guys were mostly dealing in Xanax, and Mikey was charged with dealing cocaine. But I think another part of it is these guys all had pretty exceptional South Carolina criminal defense lawyers. They're high-priced lawyers for a reason. They're very connected. They know all the right people. I think they can sort of make magic happen sometimes.
Most of the young men arrested in the drug bust have not faced life-changing consequences.
And I think it became very clear that just because bros might be talked about as villains in movies now or more vilified on Instagram, they still have all of the same material power they always have. It's still sort of the ruling group in America. They still control how things work. And yeah, something a fraternity lobbyist told me more recently when he was talking about fraternities today, he said, yeah, my guys are more quiet than they used to. They're not as loud on campus. They don't want to be as public because they know they're sort of controversial in a way they didn't used to be. But they'll sort of tell me, like, these students can say what they want about us. They'll all be working for me one day. I think that kind of tells you all you need to know.
When Max was several months into his reporting, a source told him something truly shocking. He learned that back in 2012, less than 5 years before Patrick's murder, multiple members of the Kappa Alpha fraternity had died due to drug-related issues. In fact, the fraternity had lost three brothers in less than 6 months. What made this revelation even more startling was that no one else he'd spoken to had thought to mention it. Several fraternity brothers had never even heard about these deaths before. And in the wake of these deaths, the school had never launched an investigation into the fraternity.
And so the tragedy of those three deaths is also compounded by the fact that they were a chance to really have some sort of reckoning with a culture that was spiraling a little out of control, but nothing really happened. The next day you wake up and they're like, okay, well, what are we doing for semi-formal? It's truly the road goes on forever and the party never ends.
Campus Files is an Odyssey original podcast. This episode was written and reported by Margot Gray. Campus Files is produced by Ian Mont, Elliot Adler, and me, Margot Gray. Our executive producers and story editors are Maddie Sprunkheiser and Lloyd Lockridge. Campus Files is edited, mixed, and mastered by Chris Basil and Andy Jaskowitz. Special thanks to Jenna Weiss-Berman, J.D. Crowley, Leah Reese-Dennis, Maura Curran, Josephina Francis, Kurt Courtney, Hilary Schuff, Sean Cherry, Laura Berman, and Hilary Van Ornum. Original theme music by James Waterman and Davey Sumner. If you have tips or story ideas, write to us at campusfilespod@gmail.com.